We're going to be looking at Numbers chapter 16 this morning, so we'll turn to that passage. I'll just read from verse 46, but we will follow the progress of the whole chapter. But verse 46, "And Moses said to Aaron, 'Take your censer and put fire on it from off the altar, and lay incense on it, and carry it quickly to the congregation, and make atonement for them. For wrath has gone out from the Lord, the plague has begun.' So Aaron took it, as Moses said, and ran into the midst of the assembly. And behold, the plague had already begun among the people. And he put on the incense and made atonement for the people. And he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stopped." Why are we looking at this weird story this morning? It takes place amongst a group of campers in a wilderness 3,500 years ago. Aren't there more significant, pressing things that we're facing in the world today? How are we going to feed ourselves? How are we going to heat our homes this winter? What about the leadership crisis that we're facing in this country and indeed across the world? What about inflation? Shouldn't we be talking about that? Or wars and natural disasters? Is this relevant? It seems a million miles away from the world in which we're living at the moment. Well, that's a good question, and it's a question we ought to ask. But I want you to think about all of the things that would have been happening in the world in 1500 BC, when this was written. There were economic crises going on. We know about that because Egypt was recovering from its disastrous policy of trying to fight against Yahweh, the Lord, and the land had been ruined. There were wars raging across the Middle East. It was the rise of the Hittite Empire at this time. People were craving security. They were building huge walled cities because they were so scared. There were border disputes going on. There were land grabs happening. No doubt farmers were complaining that the weather was all wrong for the harvest this year. I mean, every tribe, every nation had their gods of the weather. Baal was the god of rain and storms because you'd never ever been able to control the climate. Shoppers would have been moaning about inflation. It's a big thing in the Old Testament. There were leadership challenges going on. There's one in our chapter. People were being born, they were living, they were dying. What I'm saying is there is absolutely nothing new under the sun. And yet, the one incredibly detailed record of what was happening in 1500 BC is the eyewitness account in the writings of Moses. How much do you know about what was happening in 1500 BC? You've got some hieroglyphics in Egypt. You've got some Hittite texts on fragments of pottery that get dug out of the dust from time to time. But I haven't got minutes of the cabinet meeting in Egypt dealing with the economic crisis. They're not around. I don't know what the headlines from the Hittite Herald or the Canaan Echo were. We haven't got them. But I've got Numbers 16. And God has preserved this because this is something which is of paramount importance. This was at the heart of God's plan of grace for this world. This is part of the unfolding mystery of his plan to save men and women and boys and girls and bring them back to himself and restore all things and make all things new and good. This is the answer. It's part of God's love story that runs from Adam to Jesus to the end, without which nothing makes sense. And there isn't any hope. It's just a futile struggle for survival that ends in failure. And this chapter is tracking the greatest question of, can you approach God? Can you know this God? Can you be safe in the presence of blinding holiness and searing justice? And it's also a reminder that we are so perverse, aren't we? And we treat God so lightly, we despise him, that we will try any other way than God's way, because we really are serial rebels against God. these people, Israel, they've already been so blessed by the Lord. They've been brought by God's power out of slavery in Egypt back to God. He's made his Old Testament home with them. God has humbled himself to go camping in the wilderness with his people. He's covered them with the blood of sacrifice, the substitutes that stand in for a sinful people. He's given them a high priest to mediate on their behalf. Grace on top of grace has been lavished on this people. And the response to that grace should have been faith and love that works itself out in obedience to God. And yet they've constantly murmured and grumbled their way through the wilderness. And it's culminated in their refusal a few chapters earlier to enter the promised land. They don't trust God. They say, oh no, the people are too big and the cities are too strong. This people, are they thick? A year previously, their God had systematically taken apart the greatest superpower that history has ever known, Egypt. And because of their refusal to go in, they've been subjected to wandering in the wilderness for 40 years till that unbelieving generation die, and then their children will go into the promised land. We're not told how long we are into that 40-year period at this point. But it's evident that some people, rather than use that period to reflect on their unbelief and repent of it, are finding new ways to rebel against God, and a new wave of rebellions break out. And we're at another crisis point for the Old Testament church, and therefore for the hope of the whole world. So first of all, let's look at the rebellion, verses 1 to 3. Now, Korah, the son of Itzar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with a number of the people of Israel, 250 chiefs of the congregation, chosen from the assembly, well-known men. They assembled themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and said to them, "You have gone too far. For all in the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" Now, in those three verses, we've got a lot of information, and we can work out the who of the rebellion, the where of it, and the what it was all about. So who? We've got Korah. Did you notice him? He's from the tribe of Levi. So he's from the tribe that look after the tabernacle of God, the dwelling place of God. He's from the tribe from which the priests come. And then there are three fellows from the tribe of Reuben. Reuben was the eldest of Jacob's sons. They are Dathan, Abiram, and On. We don't hear of On again in the chapter. On seems to have gone off somewhere. But we hear about Dathan and Abiram. So there's the who. We've got people from Levi, people from Reuben, the oldest tribe. Then the where. Do you remember a few weeks ago, I put up a diagram, it was months ago now, wasn't it? Where has the time gone? We put up a diagram of the camping arrangements for Israel in the wilderness. And at the center of everything was the tabernacle, God's tent. And then around the tabernacle, to the north, the south, the west, and the east, the Levites were divided up into their families. So at the east end, where the entrance to the tabernacle was, you had Moses and Aaron's family. And to the north, you had the Merari and Gershon to the west. And then to the south was Kohath. That's Korah's tribe. So he would have been to the south of the tabernacle. And the Levites sort of served as a barrier. They were temple police to stop the people coming near to God. But outside of them, the tribes were all arranged. Three to the north, three to the west, three to the east, three to the south. And right next to Korah's tent would have been the beginning of the Reubenite tents. That's where they were based. So you can picture what's been happening, can't you? It's been one of those unholy huddles that so often break out in church history. You can picture now, they're right next to each other, Dathan and Abiram, and Korah, and Dathan and Abiram saying to their wives, "We're just popping around to Korah's this evening, and they're over a couple of lamb kebabs and a few bottles of Canaanite Chardonnay." They begin to air their grievances against Aaron and Moses. And they begin to plot and to plan and to scheme. And the knives come out and a shadow begins to creep across the Old Testament church. So what is it all about? Well, there's a full-on assault on the positions of Moses and Aaron here. Aaron, as the high priest, who represents the congregation before God, so God has put him there to stand facing him, with the congregation behind him, representing them, and there's an assault on Moses' position as God's prophet who speaks from God to the people. This chap, Korah, he's a Levite, but he's not a priest. And he's jealous of Aaron's position and responsibility. And you look at the text, his argument is that it's an easy thing to draw near to God. Anyone can do it. We are all holy. You do not need a special person to represent you before God. Moses and Aaron, you've gone too far. We can easily come before God, any of us. And at the same time, you've got Dathan and Abiram. And they're thinking, well, we should be leading the family. Why is Moses the leader? We come from the oldest tribe. We should be the patriarchs. We will not listen to Moses. And you get their defiance in verses 12 to 14. We will not come up to meet you. And they turn the covenant promises on their head. Instead, as Moses had said, or the Lord had said, we're going to bring you to a land flowing with milk and honey, they turn that round and they say, you've taken us from a land flowing with milk and honey. Moses, your gospel thing has ruined our lives. We're worse off now than ever we were before. And with a sarcastic attack on Moses' earlier life, they say, you make yourself out to be a prince among us. One thing I've noticed from Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers is that Israel did sarcasm really, really well. You make yourself to be a prince over us. Who are you kidding, Moses? That's what the words mean here. Are you pulling the wool over our eyes? You've not delivered on any of your promises. They've forgotten it was their unbelief that stopped them getting to Canaan in the first place. But they say, we won't come up. Now you've got the perfect church storm. They're able to gather 250 influential people from the whole congregation. And by verse 19, you see the whole congregation has been swayed. Then Korah assembled the whole congregation against Moses and Aaron at the entrance to the tent of meeting. This is a disaster. There isn't going to be a future for the Old Testament church. Secondly, we've got the response to the rebellion. Or responses, because we've got to follow a lot of responses to this chapter. There's the response of Moses. I love what Moses does. He doesn't take it personally. I can't understand that, because when I'm criticized, I always take it personally. And my response is because I'm hurt. But Moses is just full of grace here, and it's actually more serious than a personal attack on him. Verse 11, he says, it's against the Lord that you and your company have gathered. Moses and Aaron didn't choose these positions. I think there were times they didn't even want them. Moses had been the most reluctant person ever to be called into the service of God. He'd resisted all the way through Exodus, you remember? No, send someone else, I can't do it. And God says, no, I'm sending you. No, I can't speak. They won't listen to me. I'm too scared. And he's been forced into it. Joe Root, the former England cricket captain, was talking about how being captain of England just sucked the life out of him. He should have tried being leader of Israel in the Old Testament. And Moses wasn't even paid for it, as he says, I haven't taken a donkey from them. Aaron hadn't particularly wanted this position. It had scarred his life. He'd lost two of his sons through the priesthood. And Moses makes this point that I didn't ask for this. God had called Moses to be his prophet and Aaron to be his priest. So he says, we'll let God decide who is his, verse 5, and who is holy, who he brings near to him. And they organize this test. There are 250 self-appointed priests who say anyone can come near to God. And then there is one God, divine appointed priest, Aaron, who says, no, you are to represent the people. Then Moses gives a devastating expose of Korah's heart and mind in verse 9 following. And he says, isn't it enough, all the privileges that the Lord has given you as a Levite? Because as a Kohathite, that quarter of the Levites, they actually got to carry the Ark of the Covenant around. They got to carry the most holy things in their service of God. Do you not think it's enough to serve God, and yet you have to demand more and seek the priesthood also? The Kohathites were way above in rank their cousins from Merari and Gershon, who had to carry the tent pegs around. He had an honourable position. But oh no, Mr. Ego won't be happy till he's at the centre of attention. So there's Moses' response. Then we've got the Lord's response. As the showdown begins between the 250 impostors and Aaron, Korah gathers the whole congregation, and suddenly the glory of the Lord appeared to the whole congregation. Verse 19. God is breaking through in judgment. God's come to sort this out. They've rejected God's prophet through whom he speaks. They've rejected his high priest, whom he's given to represent them and keep them safe, which means they've rejected God as their king. And God says, verse 20, he speaks to Moses and Aaron, separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. They don't want God's way. They don't want God's mediator. They don't want God's word. They don't want God's grace. So all that's left is God's judgment. And the Bible, by right, should have ended at Numbers 16, verse 21. But it doesn't. Because still, God's ferocious covenant love won't let go of his people. And that covenant love is seen as Moses and Aaron, for the second time in this chapter, fall on their faces and they plead for the people. Oh God, oh God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with the whole congregation? You're thinking, what's that got to do with God's covenant love? That's about Moses' love and Aaron's love. Surely they're getting in between an angry God and a guilty people. Well, yes, they are, but who put them there? God did. This is what this chapter's about. They are his mediators that he has put in place between him and the people, and they're doing exactly what God intended as they act as pictures and shadows of a greater one that he's going to send, all because of his covenant love that won't let go of this people. So the Lord provides a way of escape at this point. The whole congregation were going to be destroyed and consumed. And God says, okay, get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And there's a way of escape. We're seeing what the Apostle Paul in Romans would call the severity and the kindness of God. And those two things have to go together. God has to be severe against sin, against everything that is wrong in his sight. And yet in the midst of severity, which is going to judge sin in this chapter, there is kindness that provides one way of salvation. And the people move back from Korah's tent and Dathan's and Abiram's, and suddenly the focus in this great narrative is on Dathan and Abiram. And they're standing there defiantly at the doors of their tent. You can picture them, right? Your arms crossed. What are you going to do about it, Moses? Because they don't know what happens next. They're there, defiantly standing against the one that God has sent to speak to them. And then suddenly, the ground gives way under their feet. The earth opens up and they fall alive into Sheol, into the grave. And the ground then closes over them and they perish from the assembly of God. You think, how awful. Well, it was awful because verse 30, they despised the Lord. They didn't cling to the kindness of God that always accompanies his severity in the Bible. And they were lost. But there were some unusual trophies of grace that day. I want you to notice that we didn't hear a thing about Korah's family accompanying him to his destruction. Numbers 16 was silent on that. And you think you're clutching at straws here. Well, no, I'm clutching at scripture. I want you to flick over a few pages in your Bible to Numbers 26 and verse 9. It's a census that's being taken place a little bit later. And it's remembering these events. Verse 9 says, the sons of Eliab were Nemuel, Dathan and Abiram. These are the Dathan and Abiram, chosen from the congregation, who contended against Moses and Aaron in the company of Korah, when they contended against the Lord, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, together with Korah. When that company died, when the fire devoured 250 men, and they became a warning. But the sons of Korah did not die. And there's an encouragement there. Because on that day, clearly, the sons of Korah put loyalty to their God before loyalty to their dad. And they stood with God. And their family motto became, blessed is the one who puts his trust in you. Because you've come across the sons of Korah before, haven't you, or since? Because they're the people who wrote most of the Psalms after David. In fact, you started this service by singing one of the psalms of the sons of Korah. God is our refuge and our strength. The sons of Korah wrote Psalm 84, which has that wonderful line, I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness. Now, do you understand where that came from? Do you see it now? You've read those words so many times. I've read them so many times. I've never put two and two together. Korah, their dad, was not happy with his position. He wanted more. These lads, they said, no, I'm happy with the lowest position and to be in the church of God than to be outside in the tents of wickedness. Those boys didn't stand with their dad, they stood with their God, and they were saved. But what's the response of the people to God's deliverance? Surely they're going to start worshipping God now, aren't they? Well, look, verse 41, the very next day, all the congregation of the people grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, you've killed the people of the Lord. Is that what happened? I thought Moses and Aaron pleaded for the lives of the Lord's people, and grace had spared them. And yet their response to grace is anger and accusation. And they gather together, in the camp again, all these people, then they turn round to go and get Moses and Aaron, probably lynch them in the tent of meeting. And as they turn round, behold, the text says, the cloud covered the tent of meeting and the glory of the Lord appeared. And they realize that they're marching against Yahweh. Surely it's gone too far this time. And the response of the Lord again, verse 45, is, get away from the midst of this congregation that I may consume them in a moment. If I were Moses and Aaron, I would have been out of there by now. I would not be wanting to stand in the midst of the Old Testament day of judgment. But these people did carry on standing there or falling in the midst of, in the face of the Lord there. I think that's why the Lord chose Moses and Aaron, not me, to be an Old Testament mediator. Because these people don't give up. And they remember that with the severity of God comes the kindness of God. And they fall on their faces, and Moses works out that they need a mediator. And the answer lies in a high priest. So thirdly and finally, we've got redemption. And it's there in verse 46 following. I just love the way that Moses tells the story. You get the urgency, don't you? Quickly, says Moses, run! Take your censer, put on it fire from the altar and incense on it. Quickly go to the midst of the congregation and make atonement for them. For the plague, the judgment has already begun. That word atonement, which we know as the word that Tyndale invented, at one meant to cover this Hebrew word, which is actually kippur, and the word kippur means to cover. Moses is saying to Aaron, get into the congregation and cover them. And the fire from God's altar covers the people from God's anger. You can picture this old man, and he's an old, old man, Aaron now, running into the danger zone, going into the front line of the battle, taking his place between the dead and the living as he meets the encroaching judgment of God. You can see this high priest making himself unclean as he marks the line between death and life. He's putting his own life on the line. And the irony of it all is that this is the high priest that they have just been despising and rejecting. Their only hope on that day was the priest they said they didn't need and they didn't want. In chapter 17, Aaron is vindicated by God as his appointed high priest. And at the end of the chapter, chapter 17, verse 12, the people have gone full circle now. We began the story by saying, anyone can come into the presence of God. End of chapter 17, they say, nobody can come into the presence of God. We're all doomed. There's no hope. We're all undone. We all perish. Well, you can see where God's moving the story on to, can't you? A day when the tabernacle of God was actually going to come near to us. When God sent not an Aaron, but his own dear son from the glory of heaven down into the world that he'd made. And this time, the glory of the Lord didn't appear in cloud and fire. It appeared in kindness and love shining out of a real human face. This flawless high priest, this better Aaron, stooped down into the midst of the grumblers and the perversity of this world and the complainers and the rejecters. And he showed the kindness of God as he healed sickness and he drove back darkness and he made the unclean clean and he gave life to the dead. He preached the gospel to the poor. The people who had nothing heard that they could have everything in him. He promised full forgiveness for all of their sins. This better high priest, this better prophet, this better king came saying, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. I am the only way. I am God's way back to God. So what did we do? Well, we did what rebellious people have done to God all the way through history. We despised and we rejected him. We spat into his face and called him a blasphemer. We put him on trial and found him guilty. We found God guilty and deserving of death. Well, surely now we're going to get the last Numbers 16, verse 45 in history, aren't we? Twice God had said in Numbers 16, get out of their midst, I'm just going to consume them. Well, as we condemn and reject his son that he sent to save us, surely God's going to tear open the heavens and say to his servant son, get out of their midst. Let me deal with them properly this time. But no, heaven was silent because the Father had sent his son to take your place. And the kindness of God's grace was going to fall on you as the severity of his judgment for your sin would fall on Jesus. And Jesus didn't run to the front line of the battle waving a pan of incense and hot coals around. He hung on a cursed cross, praying for us, offering his perfect life as payment for all your sins, that atonement might be made, that you properly might be covered. And judgment came crashing over him, and he consumed it all as he cried, I've done it. It's all finished. And he gave his life for us. And as he did that, he tore open the way into the presence of God. And he rose from the dead to act as a perfect mediator, a great high priest who can and will bring all who trust him into the presence of his Father, into the Holy of Holies. The greatest commentary on Leviticus and Numbers that has ever been written, I've said it before, is the book of Hebrews. I don't know why anybody's bothered to write a commentary on Numbers and Leviticus when it's already been written for us in Hebrews. And Hebrews chapter 10, verse 21 says this, since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us draw near. That's what Numbers 16 was all about. Who can draw near? Anyone can draw near, beginning of the chapter. No one can draw near, end of chapter 17. Hebrews says, you can draw near because you've got a great high priest who's opened up the way into the presence of God for you. And you can draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith. You can come where angels wouldn't tread and look into the face of the Ancient of Days and say, Abba, Father. But Hebrews 10 goes on to become one of the two most frightening chapters of the New Testament. The other is Hebrews 6. But Hebrews 10, having described this wonderful only way into the presence of God through the high priest, through Jesus, goes on to say, if we go on sinning deliberately, after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sin, but the judgment and fire that consumes the adversaries. God, in other words, doesn't have anything else now to give. He's given it all in Jesus Christ. And all the grace and all the love and the kindness of God is found in him. But you reject him, then all God's got left for you is the fire of his judgment. And that chapter finishes Hebrews 10 by saying, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. I think if Dathan and Abiram could come back to us today, they would say it is. But I think if the sons of Korah could come to us today, they'd say But you know, it's a wonderful thing to run into the arms of the living God. As he reaches out to you, to a sinner, and says, come in faith. So, you're going to stand defiantly at the door of your tent, like a Byron and Dathan, just saying, I don't care. I heard what you said this morning, but I won't believe. It's not I don't believe, it's I won't believe. I don't care. Or like Korah's sons, you're going to run to the hope that God in his kindness holds out to you. And I'll promise you something more than Korah said in Psalm 84. He won't make you a doorkeeper in his house. He'll make you a son or a daughter. He'll make you share Jesus' inheritance and reign with him forever and ever. You thought number 16 wasn't relevant to you in September 2022. It's the most important thing in the world. Whatever emergency budget gets produced next week sometime, it's not going to affect your eternal destiny. But this is, do I despise God or do I trust him and love him and follow him?